Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Sunita Patini, who is the author of The Transcendent Mind, The Missing Piece in Emotional Well-Being. This is a great book for analyzing emotional disruption in your life. And I think Sunita has come to the realization that we all have very, very common problems and common solutions. Thank you so much for joining us, Sunita.
You're welcome, Dr. Kolb.
So, do you want to give a little bit of your history? You are a psychotherapist, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I've been practicing psychotherapist for a good few years now, actually. And when I first set up practice, what I realized very quickly was that some of the traditional techniques that I'd been trained in weren't working too well. And that's really when I got into, you know, the sort of exploring more about who we were at the very core. And that's really how the Transcendent Mind came about. So I guess that's kind of the journey that got me here.
Well, you had been working with your clients, in a more traditional manner, and then you yourself had some experiences that made you realize that perhaps the real underlying problems were something different and something that needed to be addressed by, a more comprehensive look at who we really are.
Yeah, absolutely. So what actually happened was, I started having clients and the traditional techniques weren't working too well. And so I started at about that time, somebody had actually recommended that I read A Course in Miracles and the Hindu spiritual text, the Bhagavad Gita. And so I went ahead and, you know, I started reading these texts. And what really stood out in both of these texts was this idea that we had a soul. And, you know, I mean, it's not the first time I've come across that. I am, you know, sort of I've been born into the Sikh religion. So, you know, we've always kind of heard the term soul come about. But I think that's really the first time where I actually really gave it proper thought, you know, and I thought, okay, well,
right.
And I'm quite logical, you know, I'm quite scientific. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, if we do have a soul, where do I go to find evidence that there is a soul? And that's really when I started reading around the topic of near-death experiences, which were absolutely monumental, I think, to my work. And the more I read and researched about near-death experiences, the more I became very interested in how some of these experiences were having huge psychological, transformations, and in minutes once they'd had the near-death experience. And, you know, I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because that's what we look to achieve in psychotherapy. So what is it that you've recognized during that experience that we haven't? And my second question was, well, can we replicate that so that we can start to, bring that into therapy?
So one of the things you talk about in the book is dichotomies. And we hold within our nature different dichotomies, and it's actually the interaction of these dichotomies that can create emotional problems.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, you know, dichotomies, I think, really run in different themes throughout our lives. So we have like natural dichotomies. So when we look at nature, for example, you know, we'll have night and day, up and down, that sort of thing. But when we're looking at ourselves, you know, what became really evident through reading and research was that there are really two aspects to ourselves. It's like we have a personal immanent consciousness as well as a transcendent consciousness. So it's like we're part of two things at the same time. And, you know, I guess the only way to explain it for me is that if you imagine an ocean, an ocean has all these amazing qualities. And if I take a droplet of that ocean, the droplet is still the ocean, and yet it's separate at the same time. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And so that's how I really relate to this idea of, you know, this sort of this unified energy or this unified soul, so to speak. So we are both individual. We both have a personal consciousness as well as being connected to a much larger consciousness all at the same time. And I think learning how to integrate that dichotomy is really, really the key to emotional well-being, I would say.
So when you are dealing with people with significant emotional problems, one of the things you said is that prior emotional or negative emotional experiences and even emotional experiences of ancestors can cause, I guess, disturbances and decreased energy within the person. How do you go about finding out where these are and helping resolve these?
Oh, do you know what? That's a brilliant question, and it's a massive question. so I'll try to keep
especially the ancestor part. I love the one about your, you know, the overeating might be an ancestor that was in a famine.
Absolutely. So, okay, so I'm going to try to give a generic answer to this, because when I work with people, it's very individual. So it's very intuitive as well when I work with people. So, you know, you just get a feeling mm-hmm. for where to go next with it. But the general gist is this, is that when we experience trauma, the trauma is actually stored in our body, you know, and trauma is such a fascinating topic. I do a lot of work with trauma. And so when that trauma is stored in the body, obviously when we go on to have, you know, children, the trauma is, because energetically a trauma can be passed down to the child, although it might be dormant. So it's not necessary that, you know, the child's going to be born with the exact same issues as you. But you see, when that child has been triggered, and it could be anything, could be an environmental trigger, could be some, you know, something that someone says to them, you know, there's a chance that that particular propensity will, you know, awaken, let's say. Now, if that is the case, I guess, like I said, I try to keep it generic, but if that is the case, usually what I do is, first of all, I'll explore a lot about the person themselves. So I really look at timelines and really have a look at what's going on with the person. And then if we find that, you know, we can't find anything with the person, I'll then also ask about, you know, the person's parents or their ancestors or whatever, you know, so we start to form some sort of a picture. And usually the client, it's amazing actually, can tell intuitively whether the issue is theirs or not. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, it does.
You know, so that's how I tend to maneuver that particular, you know, that particular issue, really. And then I also sometimes I'll use muscle kinesiology or sway testing techniques, you know, to sort of be certain about whether that's where the trauma's coming from. So there's a number of sort of processes that I use in order to work with that.
Yeah, I think muscle testing is a really brilliant way to determine causation. I do that a lot with physical disease and have determined the cause of a huge number of physical diseases, and they're not always what people think they are or medicine thinks they are. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we could probably decrease healthcare costs quite a bit, and probably mental health care costs quite a bit if we could get to causation, because things are more easily released than people realize. You know, emotional freedom techniques and other things.
Yeah.
There's a lot of technologies involved that can release stuff.
So quickly as well. You know, you're so right. I use a lot of EFT, and I use a lot of matrix re-imprinting with clients as well. And it is amazing. If you know where to go, you're so right. If you know where to go to get to the bottom of what created that belief system, it is absolutely amazing what can be done to really resolve it. You know, it's fascinating, fascinating stuff.
So do you ever treat the opposite of bulimia, which would be anorexia nervosa?
I don't treat anorexia. I treat bulimia and binge eating, because I think that, well, this is just my personal opinion. I think that in anorexia as well as bulimia, it's such a specialized field, because you're dealing with a different, you know, different sort of symptom. So, you know, you're having to look at the nourishment and whether the person is, you know, what their levels are like in terms of their body and their blood levels and all sorts of things. So my specialism really is looking at binge eating because I have a lot of history in binge eating, actually. So, you know, so that's where I tend to focus my work, really.
So what would you say, in your experience, I know there's different causes of overeating. There are some people that, you know, overeat for emotional reasons, and then there's other people that overeat for that really don't overeat but become obese, say if they have mold biotoxin exposure, because their leptin receptors are really damaged by the biotoxins. So, you know, I have patients who are overweight, but then when we treat their mold and get the biotoxins out of their system, they can lose 50 pounds without even dieting, which is wild.
Yeah.
So there's, there's lots of different. But in terms of binge eating, what would you say is the most common, I guess, emotional issue involved that you see?
Okay, so the first thing that I would say is really one of the key things when I work with binge eaters is really understanding the difference between emotional eating and binge eating, and also overeating, because I think that, you know, most people overeat occasionally. You know, I think that's a natural thing. So when we have, you know, special occasions and things, we all overeat, you know, from time to time. Okay, and then really we have emotional eating. So emotional eating is really when your trigger to eat is the result of an emotion that you're having. So, you know, you often hear people saying that I eat when I'm bored or when I'm tired or when I'm stressed or, you know, a number of emotions. Binge eating, however, is actually, I think, quite different. And the reason I say that is because, you know, before I was a therapist, I was actually a chronic binge eater. I had binge eating disorder to the, oh God, I think I'm one of the worst cases actually that I've ever seen. Okay. And so one of the reasons, so when I say I'm a binge eating expert, I literally mean I'm a binge eating expert. You know, so when I was looking into my own recovery and really self-healing, I tried everything. You know, I tried CBT, I've read about emotional eating, and, you know, something just wasn't hitting the spot. And I was like, no, I'm not. I mean, yes, I do eat emotionally, but not to the extent that it's causing the binging. And then slowly, as I started to, you know, research, I really started to recognize, and I'd read it 100 times before, but I don't think I really internalized it, that binge eating is predominantly caused by mental or physical restriction where food is concerned. You know, and a lot of people listen to that and they say, well, what do you mean, Sunita? You know, do you mean that, you know, like, what, I just allow myself to eat everything? And it actually took me a long time to realize that I'd spent so long dieting and I'd spent so long worrying about my body image and that I wasn't good enough, that I had a constant mental and physical restriction going on. So the first thing that I had to do to reverse that was actually completely, and I was 60 pounds heavier because I gained a lot of weight with the binging. So the first thing that I started looking at doing was actually I had to shift my mindset about myself, that, you know, get off the treadmill, get off the hamster wheel, and actually stop worrying about the weight. That's the first thing I did, ironically. I decided that I wasn't going to weigh myself. And then very slowly I started getting in tune with when I was hungry, when I was full, not restricting myself with food, but having to almost learn how to eat in a way that was healthy for me, without diet mentality kicking in. So that is quite a specialized journey. You know, it's complete opposite of diets, but it worked. And it wasn't an easy journey, but, you know, it healed the binge eating disorder. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
So when you, that was kind of like the mechanism of how you were able to lose the weight, but did you ever find out why you had the binge eating, or do you think you might have had the binge eating in order to, you know, heal yourself and help others heal?
No, I think that, like I said, I think the key reason, and I do want to say, and I know that a lot of people don't agree with this, but an absolute fundamental a fundamental way of me breaking free from binge eating disorder was to actually not put my focus on the weight. That's the first thing I want to say, that I got to a stage where I had to change my mindset that I was focusing on health regardless of what my weight would do. So I kind of came to the point that even if I never lost another pound, I wasn't bothered. I just didn't want to be haunted by the binge eating anymore, you know. But then I guess what happened was that the more you focus on health, you know, your body kind of it normalizes the way it's supposed to, you know, when you start working out and you know, really looking at your eating. But I think the binge eating, predominantly my binge eating, the key cause, I think there's a combination of things. The first thing was that I'd had very low self-esteem from a very young childhood, you know, young childhood. And the second thing was restriction with food. I'd always restricted because I was worried about getting fat, ironically. And eventually I just got to a point where I couldn't restrict anymore, and there you go, fully, you know.
So you think the binging is kind of like a result of the restriction. It's kind of like a, you know, it's the opposite, but the more you restrict, the more you binge.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a pendulum. You know, like I said, that's not going to be the case with everybody with binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've worked with hundreds of clients now with binge eating disorder, and it's certainly the case with a majority of them. You know, and it's such a shame to see, because actually these people, you know, they wake up every day wanting to change, wanting to lose weight, and the intentions are all brilliant. And the mechanisms that they're using are just not working, and in fact, they're worsening. You know, diets, and I say to everyone, guys, we're not designed to diet. Your body is wise enough to know what it needs. It's just that we've lost touch with it.
Mm-hmm. You know, would you say that low self-esteem is something that you see frequently in binge eaters?
Yeah, I would say so, quite often. You know, low self-esteem stroke low body image. You know, they've got a very low... If you really look at it, why would you restrict your eating? From a binger's perspective, by the way, this is where anorexia can be slightly different. So from a binger's perspective, most people will come in and say, well, I didn't just start binge eating all of a sudden. It was, you know, it was a progression. So I started off with not feeling so good about myself. I felt like I had to lose weight, or I had, you know, or my friends were dieting or whatever it was. That's very common. And then as I got older, I realized that the diets just weren't working and I was having more cheat days. And then I couldn't control the cheat days anymore. This is a very common story that I hear. And before you know it, you know, over the months or over the years, it's you slowly slip into binge eating disorder.
So you mentioned before that one of the first books that you read was A Course in Miracles. How would you say that book affected you in terms of the things we've been talking about, you know, the low self-esteem and that type of thing? How is that? That book is primarily about forgiveness. Is it a matter of forgiving yourself for, you know, the back and forth behaviors?
I think definitely. I think, you know what happened with a lot of this? First of all, so I went from training in psychotherapy. And then when I read A Course in Miracles, that kind of started off me wanting to learn more about our transcendent natures. Okay, so the idea of forgiveness, the idea of compassion, the idea that we're all connected, that we're, you know, unity and that sort of thing. But if I'm honest with you, there was still a gap in my therapeutic knowledge or the way that I was treating people, because I understood what the problem was, and I understood that there was this vast consciousness that there was part of, and I understood that we needed to understand and, you know, really put forgiveness and compassion and all of these wonderful things into place. I understood that. But what I was still finding was that, you know, people would come in, they'd learn about this, and they'd be fascinated with the whole spiritual topic, the fact that we're something bigger and, you know, really get into the near-death experiences. But the key question was always, well, how? How do I forgive? You know, so-and-so's done this to me and I just can't seem to... I know that's what I'm supposed to do, but I can't do it. So in one respect, I think A Course in Miracles is brilliant because that's really where the Transcendent Mind, the book, was inspired and where it's come from. But I think since then, I really worked on refining, okay, so let's really look at what forgiveness is, you know, letting go of whatever you're holding on to. And like we mentioned earlier, one of the key ways to do that is through energy psychology, you know, really releasing, working on releasing the emotional body and the memories that we hold. And I think that when we do that, forgiveness, compassion, and all of these beautiful, you know, archetypes become a lot easier to manifest.
So let's go back and talk about something like how the mechanism of how if something bad happens to you, like you're raped in high school, and that causes a lowering of your self-esteem, and that gets trapped in your body. I mean, the energy of that actually literally gets trapped in your body. What sort of, other than, say, reading The Course in Miracles to get the, you know, maybe doing the workbook, what else would you be doing to release that energy?
Okay, so the first thing that I would do is I would first ask the client, I would try to ascertain on what level the trauma has affected the person. So I work across four levels. So I look at the mental state, the emotional or the vital state. I look at the physical body and I look at the intuitive side of us. Okay. Mm-hmm. So my first question or my first point of inquiry is always, okay, so you've, like the example you've given, you know, in a very gentle way, obviously, I'd ask these questions. Okay, so you've endured this trauma. You know, how does this trauma manifest in your life? So you've got the low self-esteem or the depression or whatever it is that's come on. How is it manifesting in your life? So through understanding that, so some people will say, I can't really feel anything, but I have incessant thoughts about it, you know, if they've dissociated, for example. Some people will say, well, you know, I've got PTSD and I have nightmares and the emotions are really bad. So that's the first thing that I'll do. So once I've ascertained where it is, then I know where to go with therapy. So what usually happens in a vast majority of cases is that I will have... clients will often say, okay, I can feel the feeling here, there, and everywhere. So usually I will then work with energy psychology. I'll build a timeline, you know, of what's happened, and I'll start to use energy psychology to actually release that, usually through EFT or matrix re-imprinting. Once we've gotten to the stage where the memories, you know, I mean, the memory will always be there. It's just that it won't be emotionally charged anymore.
Right,
therefore,
yeah.
It won't affect them in the same way. Okay, so it will still be there, but it will just be, yes, that was an experience that I had, and I've learned from it, and I'm ready to move on. Now, once we've tackled that, because for me, you know, where I work, the people that I work with, my first priority is always looking at the mental and emotional first. After I've done that, then I will bring in concepts of, okay, let's talk about your concept of forgiveness, or let's talk about your concept of compassion. And that's really when we begin to explore, because, you know, what I find is that going straight into forgiveness or talking about A Course in Miracles or whatever it is, if the person's holding a lot of trauma or a lot of emotional wounding,
right,
it becomes very difficult for them to actually, you know, get to that place. And then they get angry with themselves that, God, I know I have to forgive, but I'm not forgiving, you know. Mm-hmm. So I really, really focus, first of all, release the trauma. That's the first thing that I'll work on, you know, focusing with the client.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the Joe Black story, because I think it's a remarkable story. You know, can I just let you tell the story so that people can understand the depth at which this forgiveness can occur? Because it's really incredible.
Absolutely. And I think what's really beautiful about this story, as you'll soon see, is the way that Tom Hudgens, who I'll explain in a minute, actually accesses, and, you know, the journey to how he actually manages to forgive. So the idea of John Black, the story about John Black is that there's a guy called Tom Hudgens in this story. So when Tom was 9 years old, when his sister was 22, and when his sister was 22, she was raped and murdered by somebody called John Black. And obviously it was a massive ordeal for the family. And it's something that understandably stayed with Tom for many, many years. And I think it was when Tom hit, I think it was his 30s, he decided to join a meditation class. And he started practicing meditation, and one day in his meditation, he just had a voice in his head, I think, or a thought that, you know, popped in and said, well, you can forgive him, you know. And so I think Tom spoke to his meditation teacher, and the meditation teacher, you know, sort of said, well, Tom, will you forgive John? So this story is really about how Tom actually really goes through the process of arranging to meet John Black. And it took a long time. I think it took about a year or so for them to actually meet, because he had to go through the whole process. John was still in prison. And eventually they met, and it was the most beautiful meeting, because initially, obviously, they went through the whole why John did it. And it was interesting because John hadn't actually ever done anything like this before. And John, you know, often says that I don't know why I've done this, but you know, even though your sister's not here anymore, she still lives on through me. Because what happened in the process, John actually became the person in prison, he kind of reformed, that other people would go to for hope. And at the end of the story, what basically happens is Tom and John, they have a hug and they both, you know, released a substantial amount of pain. And it was just beautiful to watch forgiveness in action, really.
Yeah, there's a lot of... there's a lot of suggestion out there that people can be influenced from not just what is going on in the third dimension. There's a lot of, take the concussion syndrome behaviors. I've been studying this for a while, and head trauma, hormonal changes, drugs, alcohol, and other things such as this, I believe, can influence people being influenced from things in other dimensions. So, you know, a lot of the concussion stuff, which is just now coming out, I'm sure it existed for many years, but as a society we didn't recognize it. But a lot of the behaviors that the concussion syndrome people have, they often don't remember what behaviors they engaged in. And the same is true for people like John Black. He has no idea why he did that. And other people also have behaviors that they don't even remember. And Ted Bundy once, before he was put to death, Ted Bundy appeared on a radio show with a minister and made a plea for everybody to control pornography, because Ted said it was pornography that got him into the state. In other words, he started with, you know, certain kinds of pornography. It got worse into more violent kinds, and then finally he acted them out. And he said, you know, this was kind of like opening a door into this dimension. So I think, you know, I think the old-time religion that we all, or many of us, grew up with, you know, with the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, there really is certain things that open up to a realm where things can influence us that maybe later on we have to say we have no idea why we did that, when actuality is that it might be head trauma, it might be drugs. If you look online, there's a drug called Flakia. And essentially, it's demonic possession. I mean, these people, there's videos of these people. They're running naked down the street, and they throw themselves at a moving car window. I mean, you know, they go up against the window of a moving car. They get a tremendous violently, you know, they get thrown off, and yet they get up, and they go do it again. I mean, nobody in their right mind would ever be able to even do that. They have superhuman strength. Everything that the exorcism priests say that they see during exorcisms. So I really believe that there is this realm where we can be influenced, and, you know, and so that would even be more, I guess, more fuel for forgiveness to be justified. Because if you really are influenced, taken over and influenced, and rape, murder, commit suicide, whatever, because you're not in your right mind, that's, you know, I think that happens more often than we know.
I would agree with that, you know, I would agree with that, because there are so many, you know, a number of case studies that I've looked at, and you're quite right, you know, especially with some of the case studies with sort of children, you know, who have really kind of loving parents, but are yet displaying really, really dangerous behavior, and they just can't seem to work out why this is happening, you know.
Ted Bundy was like that, by the way. Ted was he wasn't from the typical family that serial killers come from.
Right, right. It's interesting, isn't it, that you just this is so much at play, and there's so much we just don't, you know, or we're beginning to learn, or, you know, we don't know enough about. But there's so much out there. I mean, you know, in a slightly different context. You know, my husband is Hindu by faith, and you know, when somebody passes away in the Hindu culture, actually it's quite similar in ours as well. When someone passes away, they do like a number of prayers that they have to do for a certain number of days. And the idea is that it allows the soul to pass over peacefully. And, you know, we had an instance where in my husband's family, one of his family members, the final rites weren't performed the way that he'd expected them to be performed. And it actually influenced years down the line, you know, it actually really influenced the grander family in quite a way. And then so when they had a religious gathering, you know, one of the messages that came through was that, you know, so-and-so's passed away, and he's coming through with a message saying that he's not meaning to create obstacles for you guys. It's just that his final rites haven't been performed and he can't move on, you know. And then so my husband had to go and perform his final rites and do what needed to be done for him. And, you know, after that was done, the rest of the family, whatever obstacles were in place, started to shift. So it is really fascinating when we really start looking at other realms and, you know, how they function.
Yeah, we've had a number of experiences here at the center. Both of my parents are in spirit now, but they're very much involved in protection of the center and also the family. A situation happened where my brother, who had recent surgery for a cancer, but it was totally taken away, so he thought that the cancer was, you know, gone, but unbeknownst to him, they put a smart meter on his Cape house, and he just spends weekends there, but evidently was close enough to his bedroom that there was a problem. So my nurses in surgery, the charts were flying off the cart. I mean, they were just flying off by themselves in surgery, and my nurses are really funny. My nurse said, "Your parents are trying to talk to you again." So I listen, you know, I'm in surgery. I listen and I hear, you know, first of all, I heard to tell him, and then I did tell him, but then he didn't do it, you know. So then I heard again, you have to tell him again, you know, because he didn't do it. And so my brother doesn't believe in the afterlife quite like I do, you know, because he doesn't experience these things. But I said to him, "Mom and Dad are so insistent on this that they're throwing charts off during surgery. You need to get that smart meter off your house." And then they turned the light on in the OR the other day, in an OR we weren't using. So I go into the OR and I tell my staff, "Would you please turn out that light?" And they both look at me with big eyes going, "We didn't turn it on." Like, so I ask again, and my parents want me to start taking Pepto-Bismol again. Pepto-Bismol helps kill the spirochete that can cause atherosclerotic disease. You might remember that when people have periodontal disease, they have a high risk of atherosclerotic disease. That's because the spirochete that's in the mouth has also been found in the arterial plaque. But Dr. Norm Shealy came up with the idea, which evidently is correct, that if you take Pepto-Bismol twice a day for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, several times a year, you can keep killing off the spirochete. It may be the barium, I'm not sure, but anyway, it prevents atherosclerotic disease from progressing, which is important because, of course, heart attack and stroke are probably the number one killers in the Western world. So, and both my parents had coronary artery bypasses in their 70s. So, you know, so they probably had that disease as well. So, you know, but it's interesting that in spirit, they know everything and they can help us. And evidently, your husband's relative, they can also hurt us. You know, like if they want to get our attention, they can do things that you know, that, like you said in your book, the uncle wasn't trying to cause problems. He was just trying to get their attention. You know, so he was making bad things happen, thinking that then they would ask why are bad things happening, and he could speak with them. You know, I'm glad my parents are choosing to throw charts off the cart and turn lights on rather than having bad things happen in my life, you know. But
absolutely. It is, and I think this is why, you know, this is, I think, also another reason why the field of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences and parapsychological research, really, this is why I think it's so important, because, you know, understanding, or just the dialogue that we're having at the moment, opens up so many doors for people to explore different things and different realms and different explanations for what they're going through. And I think that was really my key thing with writing The Transcendent Mind, was really about opening up, hoping, you know, making it quite a simple enough introduction for people to recognize, especially in sort of mainstream psychology here in the UK, that there's more to us than just, you know, we're not just Newtonian. It's not just cause and effect, that there's more to us than that meets the eye, effectively. And I think that I've experienced with my clients that when we open up that part, that realm, emotional healing takes on a life of its own, you know. So I think it's so important to talk about these things and to explore them further, really.
One thing I'd like you to tell the story about is that person who had the near-death experience that ended up being this amazing journey where he saw everything, and then what happened to him when he came back in. And I just want to talk a little bit about the fact that we're entering an era when I think all of us will realize that the answers to any problem and any question and all of the diseases and pollution and nuclear waste and, you know, all of the really big problems that we're having, that we have the answers within us. So would you mind telling that story? Because it really gives a lot of hope, I think.
It does, and I'm just trying to think. You know, there were quite a few stories in this book. I think the one you're talking about is the one about Mellon Thomas Benedict.
Right, that's the one. He becomes an inventor when he comes back.
He does, yeah. And if you just hold on, I've actually got shared it, because that was a remarkable one, wasn't it?
It was. It really was.
Let me just have a look. You know, I've looked at so many cases of near-death experiences. I've researched so many of them that sometimes they become quite kind of, you know, that one just melds into the other. But yeah, his case was quite interesting because he'd had cancer. And he had a remarkable journey, actually, because when he passed over, he actually ended up spending time, according to, he doesn't know exactly how long it was, but time according to them, and he basically got the secrets, many, many universal secrets, you know, and he's since become, absolutely, and he's since become an inventor, and he's working on, you know, a lot of interesting things that he knows that, you know, it's time to work on. But it's amazing because he sort of said that he gained basically the universal secrets, you know, what we're all about, how we function, how the universe was formed, how the planets were formed. You know, it's absolutely amazing. And actually, there's also another one that I didn't put in the book, which was, and I don't know, have you heard of Dr. George Rodenayer?
No, huh?
Okay, I think that's probably the most, for me anyway, that's one of the most amazing near-death experiences that I've ever read, because Dr. George Rodenayer was actually, he's passed away now, but he had, I think, had a some of the gang. I think he had a particular gang that were after him for some reason. Anyway, they tried to kill him, and they left him for dead, and he survived. Well, supposedly he survived. And they've taken him to hospital, and they've pronounced him dead. He went to, they put him in the morgue. He was in the morgue for 3 days, and when they came to do his autopsy, the doctor who was performing his autopsy went to cut him, and you know, George has opened up his eyes. And sometimes, obviously, that happens. So they've closed his eyes, they've gone to cut him again, and George has opened the eyes again. And a third time round, they've gone to, you know, cut him, and the autopsy doctor said, he said, you know, I looked into George's eyes, and I realized that this guy was actually alive. The people who are alive have a certain different look in their eyes. And, you know, subsequently, the doctor who was performing the autopsy had to actually take a couple of months off work. He was, quite traumatized. But what was actually really interesting was what had happened to George in between the time, you know, whilst he was supposedly dead. So he as well was shown many of the Universal secrets. He also had this case where he'd actually managed to infiltrate his wife's thought process. And when she found out afterwards, I think it was a case that she didn't speak to him for almost a year afterwards, because she felt so violated that he knew everything she'd been thinking, you know. Which was quite interesting. And then, and also during that time when he was supposedly dead, a friend of his had given birth and the baby wouldn't stop crying. And throughout George's journey, he'd communicated with the baby telepathically, finding out why the baby wouldn't stop crying. I think it was the baby had, I think, either an issue with the arm or the hip. I can't remember. So one of the first things that George did when he, you know, when he was came back to life again, was sort of say, okay, well, you know, so-and-so's baby won't stop crying. This is the problem. Mm-hmm. And of course it was. And I think that's one of the most fascinating case studies I've ever read, because 3 days, I mean, being dead for 3 days, that's just amazing, isn't it?
That is incredible. And I think I did hear the story about somebody cutting the chest and then having the person wake up. But, you know, that could have been a different person. But it does illustrate something that I think is important, that I've been told by my dead relatives, as well as, you know, the spirits and archangels that communicate with us in session, is that when you are in spirit, you can do an infinite number of things simultaneously. So it's no big deal for Jesus or anybody who people call on to pay attention to that person's needs. In other words, if you can do an infinite number of things simultaneously, then you're more than happy to help as millions and millions of people that may call on you. And that, I think, you know, some people don't call on help from the spiritual world because they don't feel worthy or they don't want to bother them. But I guess it is very important to understand, since they really do want to help us, that we should call on them. And we should call on them not just for important things, but even for finding parking spaces. You know, that's perfectly valid, too. You know, there's no, I think the Course in Miracles actually addresses that point, saying that there's no order in the difficulty in miracles. Isn't that right? They say they're all the
absolutely.
Same.
Absolutely. They're all the same, yeah. And I think that's, I remember that being one of the most prominent things, actually, that stuck out to me, that it really doesn't matter. It's not the size of them. It's just, doesn't matter how small or big it is. It's just, it's not a bother. And I think that's such an important point, because I think, in the human incarnations that we're living, we tend to be very linear in our thoughts.
Right.
You know, when people pass over, you know, the best word that I can use to describe it is that they're very quantum in their thought. You're right, it's simultaneous, multi-sensory, expansive experience that they have. And actually, it's interesting, because I'm actually doing some research at the moment in my PhD and stuff. I'm doing some research that's looking at how therapists can actually become, really tap into that quantum thought process, you know, discontinuity when they're working, rather than just being linear, because I think it's not just about the tools and techniques as a practitioner. It's also about how intuitive you are and how effectively you can get yourself out of the way to pick up what's going on In a very expansive way. So when I work with people, for example, and I don't know how to put it into words other than I can feel the person in a very four-dimensional way, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a, I can't put it into words because it's not linear. It's not like I'm analyzing you or this is the
right.
way that you are, but it's just that when I'm in your energy, I can feel your energy and it's not
mm-hmm.
linear. And sometimes it's almost as if I receive blocks of intuition or thought, if that's what you want to call it, and I kind of just get a very good idea of what's going on with that person. But that isn't a linear process. That's definitely some sort of discontinuity, quantum type, you know, thought process that's going on there. So
I think we can merge with the person. I do this when somebody has something I don't know what they have wrong with them. And muscle testing, I use to confirm it, but when I don't have any idea, I'll merge with them, and then I'll feel the blockages within my body. So
exactly.
I have an idea of what's going on with them because I actually feel it in mine because I'm an empath. And then I'll use muscle testing to confirm that I got it right. And sometimes it's really weird. Sometimes it's a malfunction that's really not described in the medical books. You know, it's not, like, known. Okay, so there's no files to go back to it on. I mean, you really have to actually just sit there and listen to Spirit explain it to you, because there's things that I'm operating on that are in no medical books. They've never been described.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild? But the patients make it to me because, you know, I guess because I have that ability to do that detective work.
Absolutely, and it's beautiful the way that you describe that. Absolutely beautiful, you know. It is. It's really just about, I guess, tuning in, and the messages do come. You're just guided. Well, at least I am, and I can see that you are.
Sure.
Just to work with people in the way that they need to be, you know, worked with.
But this is what all of us are going to be able to do. You're doing it in psychotherapy. I'm doing it in surgery. But everybody is going to be able to do this shortly. I mean, the energy that we're going to be living in is going to be very conducive to this. And I think it's just in time because we have so many very, very significant and serious problems. I mean, the water problems we have in Flint, Michigan, the nuclear waste problems in Japan, the crazy things going on in Syria where Russia and the U.S. are squaring off against each other and threatening nuclear weapons. I mean, come on, you know.
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane what's going on in the world right now. Things are not safe, you know, they're really not. And they threaten the entire planet because, obviously, we live in a delicate ecosystem that radioactive problems in one area can quickly become damaging to, you know, people all over the world and ecosystems all over the world. You know, if the oceans are contaminated, we're in trouble.
Yeah, in a very significant way.
Yeah, so it is just in time. And sometimes I'm just amazed at the information that they can get to us. But all of these problems are solvable. We just have to get people used to asking for help. You know, because we don't know how to do things. I mean, and years of scientific research are years of scientific research, and it can be very, very expensive. I think instead we just need to be given the answers to things, and then we need to prove they work. You know, we need to take.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
We need to quit spending all this money on research that does absolutely nothing. You know.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, isn't there, really? I think also, you know, with regards to some of the world's problems, you know, go back to basics. We've got to change the way education's, you know, done. We've got to get people to go, kids to go within. I think a lot of the focus is just, there's too much focus on, obviously, profit and not enough focus on much else, really. You know, we just need a paradigm shift, don't we? All together, we're working on a paradigm shift.
Yeah, well, hopefully that's in the next few years, and that we'll see a lot of the insanity, which is trying to get things to change but doing the same thing. Hopefully the insanity will stop, and we can actually start being effective rather than you know, the same old stuff. Well, we're coming up on the end of the hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yep, absolutely. So you can find out more on more about me on www.sunitapatani, that's SunitaPatani.com. And there's, you know, quite a lot of just contact information on there. There's some blog posts that I've written up on there, and you just learn more about the books and things. The books, of course, are available from Amazon. And, yeah, I look forward to really hearing from people. So it's kind of cool. It's a great journey.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Interviewing Sunita Patani on The Transcendent Mind, The Missing Piece, PEACE, and Emotional Well-Being. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next week, we will be interviewing Jeff Stegman and Caitlin Stegman on the creation and maintenance of high consciousness fields. And then Dr. Rasdeni on Take Back Control. Please join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.